You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to New World Pictures Podcast, where we're going to talk about everything New World Pictures. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
I'm so happy to be here. Thanks, everybody, for inviting me.
You're always invited, Mark. And Erica.
Oh.
I'm also happy to be here. Let's do an interview.
That's right. We decided to put in this interview. We hope you've been enjoying June Gloom 2, Down to Frown. We've gotten through Richard's Things. We've gotten through Nashville Girl, but let's take a break, guys. We all need a break. So we thought we would post this delightful second half of our interview with director Fritz Kirsch. All you NWPP VIPs know we already had a first part of this interview at the end of last year once we talked about Under the Boardwalk, the third film that Fritz directed for New World Pictures. So we're back talking Children of the Corn and Tough Turf and a terrific conversation with the delightful Fritz Kirsch. We had so much fun talking with him. Fritz is the absolute best. So we've had this one kind of locked and loaded. And we thought, you know what? Let's take a break from the drama. Let's just have a good time. And so we hope you enjoy this interview with Fritz Kirsch. Did you know that this summer, I think it's in July, they're having a screening of Children of the Corn where you shot the movie?
Oh, yeah, I've done that. The same man who talked to me, gosh, he's done it for about three times now, maybe three times over 4 years or 5 years. He has a company that takes members of companies, people participated in the films, to the locations where they've shot all over the United States.
Wow.
And I think he lives in North Carolina or South Carolina. I think he lives in a famous horror house.
Okay.
He's a nice guy. And people come to the house and, yeah, do it.
Oh, he's in deep then. He's in deep.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's got a serious Jones. You know, he's in recovery. I can't remember his name, but Courtney could not do it and was replaced by John Philbin last summer, I think. And I did it the summer before that or 2 years before that. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It sounds very cool. And
field trip. New World Pictures.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
I think the guy's name is John Sullivan. He's the guy who's had the Children of the Corn film website, I think, for many years.
John has been our archivist, historian, number one fan, first leader. He knows everything. He's the cornologist. He has an incredible collection of memorabilia and imagery and all kinds of things. He's just unbelievably deep in knowledge and the history and so forth. And he's become a friend over the years.
Oh, that's great.
Terry Kirby and I, are we recording now?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, very good. Well, then I'll tell this story because it's really quite nice. Terry Kirby, the real producer of the film, who used to be my business partner when we started making TV commercials together, he had an idea to pay back the community in which we film, basically Sioux City and the surrounding areas, with some kind of, I don't know, benefit for them, because the community theater that helped us cast local children and also atmosphere people had a flood and lost a huge amount of their wardrobe and sets and other things. Mm. So we dreamed up this idea to get the major cast, along with Terry and myself, to sign one of the background plates for the title credits.
Those
drawings.
Yeah.
Terry had the originals that were on camera. I drew a lot of them, and another woman drew a lot of them. And we had a pile like this when we were done, and we're just, here, you take some of those, you take some posters, I'll take a shirt, you know. We're just throwing stuff away, and over the years, they've become kind of nice thing to hand out. But Terry had the original one that was used, all of them, in fact. But we took the casting director's plate drawing. She's passed away. And we,
Linda Francis.
We had Courtney and John and John Franklin and myself Terry Kirby, Linda Francis, and Peter Horton all signed it, sent it around the
Wow.
country and gathered it, and then gave it to Heritage Auction last, I think it was December, and they sold it in their huge auction, which included the Wizard of Oz ruby slippers.
Oh, no
So I
kidding.
used a lot of money, and just gave the money to the community church. And John Sullivan was in the center of it, negotiating all of it for
Wow.
him. He was wonderful. He contacted the church. He kind of had the idea.
That's
Aww.
great.
That's
So he
great.
quite a remarkable man.
Yeah, for
That would be
sure.
such a cool thing to do. And I think you can even like spend a couple nights in the house or whatever that is at this point abandoned or something. Pretty cool that like 40 years on, there's still so much reverence for the movie. It really speaks to, your work on the
Right.
movie.
When I was there, and we went to the house. I mean, we drove around half the day in a bus, 50 people and myself, and I told dirty stories and talked shit on everybody. And when we got to the house was up on blocks because it was being moved like 100 feet or
Oh,
something. New
wow.
foundation had been dug, and so they were keeping the house. It's a beautiful old, turn of the century, kind of not really turn of the century, maybe 30s house, little
Wow.
farmhouse.
Yeah.
Still yellow, just it's cool.
That is
Wow.
cool. That is
Yeah.
great. And so you were just saying too, like you started your career in commercials and then you got brought into the fold of New World and into Children of the Corn. And I was going to ask if you'd brought anybody, any other crew members with you, but of course, obviously you brought Terry Kirby, but were there anybody else that you brought with over with you when you started working on Children of the Corn?
Well, a lot of the people that Terry and I hired regularly as company crew members, because in a television commercial company, you have a producer, a director, and a couple of accountants. They're very skeleton because you don't work every day, and everyone's freelance. But we have our favorites, and so we brought a lot of those favorites with us: wardrobe and some of the key grips and some of the technical people. The cinematographer was someone I met, and we searched high and low for a good cinematographer. That was kind of my background because I shot a lot of stuff before. In making commercials before I did the features. So I had an eye for those things. And they joined, and a number of them went on to make more films for New World, like the editor, Harry Karamidis. I think he did another film, but he had come from Universal or someplace, but his assistant did. And gee, I think a few of the production people did.
Speaking of your DP, João Fernandes, how did you know of him? Like, how did you meet him before?
Actually, in the process of doing things like this, you tell a few agents and they start giving you submissions. Here's a guy, here's a guy, here's a guy. So I went through a lot of show reels and looked at a lot of work and looked specifically for certain things, photographic traits and skills and the delicacies, the intricacies of stuff that I had learned. And Joao just stood out. He was terrific. He got it. He did it. I remember saying to him once, I saw in your reel a shot that you did where you hold the stop. I don't know if you know what that is,
Yeah, the
but
f-stop.
he went from inside to outside and he pulled the stop and it was perfect. And this is at a time when digital wasn't around, so it had to be accurate, so the exposure remained consistent between the exterior and the interior. And I said, dude, you're the guy, you know how to do this. This is cool. So it's that kind of stuff that showed Joao's terrific work, except for one day.
Yeah. I think that's the day that you talk about in the commentary where he gets the stop wrong or something and he sets it wrong, so it's very dark inside, but the door then opens and it has this beautiful look to it
Yeah.
as a result, but it's an accident because he really got everything kind of set up incorrectly.
Yeah, he had the flu. And we worked extremely long hours and under rotten weather conditions a lot of times, cold and hot and nights. And so it's not without reason that someone could get sick, but he unfortunately got really, and he felt bad. And he was right there because he's a real filmmaker. And he stood there and we set everything up for this to happen. And he just got the stop. He didn't set it and it was closed. But that magic, or the mistake, made magic. And so it was really cool. But the explanation to the studio executives when we watched dailies and they said, what the hell? We got to reshoot. And they're screaming and yelling because of money. I said, no. This is all about audio. Listen, listen. See, you don't know what's going to happen. See, I was too afraid to say he was sick and tell the truth. It was artistic. And, And it turned out to be good, and the story still works. It is very artistic. It's a
Yeah.
little too dark, but you know,
Yeah.
that's film at that time.
When you get brought into Children of the Corn, it's sort of like, oh, the production was sort of up and running already. Right? Wasn't it pretty much?
No,
I mean,
no.
like, I mean, did you get, I mean, I know that there was a time basically in which they had to shoot because of the corn and the season of the corn.
Right, but that was all Terry and me.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Here's the history is that there was a man named Don Borchers, whose name you've probably come across.
Sure.
He worked for Terry and me as a production accountant, production manager, doing odd jobs and being on the set assistant director and stuff when we made commercials. And we got along with him really well. And he one day said, I'm going to take this position, which he wanted to take full time with the studio, the New World. He had been hired by a man who had been at AFCO Embassy, where Don got his start as an accountant, as a bookkeeper. So there he was. In about a month's time, he came to us and said, you know, guys, you do things really well and you do them inexpensively. You know how to do this. I've got three films that they're going to make and I'm in control of a couple of them. Here they are. Pick one. I'm going to pay you back for putting ice cream in my freezer for the last couple of months for a year. So now you guys go, because I know you can do this and you're really good and you're cheap as shit. So we looked him over, and the corn was kind of the one that seemed to stand out because of its genre, because it's something that we could handle. It was not heavy in special effects, like Philadelphia Experiment was another one of the films.
Okay.
And I went to meet, I think it was Roger Burlidge at the time. He and I talked for about an hour. They had just moved into their new offices over a hamburger shop in West Los Angeles. And we talked about different things. I remember he asked me what I thought about certain horror film directors. And I said, well, George Romero is the coolest. You know, he knows how to do things cheap and it's cool and there's an emotion and blah, blah. And he said, okay, kid, you want to go make this film? And I said, well, I'll talk to my business partner. Let's see. What's the whole budget and everything? He said, oh, it's like a dollar. And he said, oh, yeah, we'll do that. So I talked with Terry. We drank a glass of beer and then we said, okay, let's go. So that was like Friday. And on Monday, we got in an airplane and started to fly around the country looking for locations. And this
Wow.
was June, I guess, or so.
Okay.
And we went to Texas and Illinois and Iowa, of course, and Nebraska, and saw in Iowa seas of corn, beautiful,
Yeah.
just oceans. And the man, there was no film commission at the time. He was a, I don't know, an agent for the government, for the state who developed commerce, kind of like a business development man. And he took us around and he was the only one that showed us any respect and interest and what we were all about and how this could turn into some money for the communities and help the economies. And so we decided that's the place. And then when we went back, being the smart geniuses we were, not thinking forward about agriculture, we went there in September and realized, oh, this son's a bitch. They've taken everything away. And they probably took the corn. What are we going to do? So they're literally one side of the street had corn and the other side of the street did not. Corn was green over here and it was dead yellow over there. So some of the corn is painted, some of it is held up with sticks and wires and all kinds of devices that you can't see. And we were then challenged to find the locations based on the, I'll call it the virility. You know, the aesthetic of the corn at that time, not because it was the perfect place, but it all worked. And it was harder and it made it more challenging, but it was still a lot of fun. It was really cool.
Speaking
Yeah,
of the
we were in it
budget,
from the very beginning to the very end.
and so speaking of the budget though, it was slightly larger, wasn't it? It goes down basically to 800,000 because of Stephen King.
Well, slightly larger meaning the overall cost, the negative cost, if you know that term, what it cost to finish the film complete, it was allocated, I don't know, $1.6 million or something. And out of that came a large amount of money for the rights, Stephen King's chunk. And then there were partners who had the script earlier who had to be paid. So they received some money, all of it distilled and reduced to about $900,000, I think, is what we had in the to go on location for the 4 weeks with the full company. So we had very little resources.
And there was another group that was also in on making it, not just the
Cinnamon.
company you're talking about, which is Hal Roach Studios, who had the script initially, but also Angelus Entertainment Group, right?
Right.
That
Yeah.
were also involved. Were they also involved in terms of the finance or?
I think they're the ones who probably, I never really got deep in the financing. The studio kind of kept those numbers away from me. Terry was more privileged, Terry Kirby,
Okay.
more privileged to watch all that. We kind of divided the work and the responsibilities over that, the creative and the fiscal, and it made
Sure.
it much easier. It was more difficult in some ways because you were told, I was told frequently, no, you can't do that. That costs a dollar, and we have 7 cents. Figure it out.
Yeah.
So, but here's an example. There's a scene where the little girl has a fever dream and she's drawing in her bed, and the camera's high in the air and it comes down on her. And we could not have any kind of regular film device, filmic tool, a crane or any arm or anything. So I talked the guys into 2x4s on a stand, and they tilted the 2x4 with a camera on the end. We made a teeter totter on a 2x4 and pulled it down, and it worked just as well and serviced, and it was about $2 worth of lumber. So
Wow.
all the effects in there are really kind of ingenious and wired together.
I mean, in a way, did you find it sort of just brought out more creativity for you because you
Oh
had
yeah.
really had no money really to speak of to make the movie?
Yeah, challenged with, the idea of something you want to see, hear, and feel, but not having what others might use as the direct tool, the perfect wrench or hammer, makes you more innovative, and it makes you think harder, more critically about it. And it gives you more, how do we get the same result? Do we do it in the audio? Do we do it with the lighting? Do we do it with some kind of cheap device like the 2x4? How can we achieve our goals? And yeah, that's the best way. And I think it's the best way any filmmaker needs to be challenged early, because if you don't exercise, you get fat.
Right,
right,
right.
Damn it. Is that what's happening to me? Oh, God. I thought it was the opposite. I thought it was if you don't
Don't
exercise, you just
exert
get damn
yourself.
it.
Yeah.
Damn it.
I mean,
I've got it all wrong.
if you just look at the history of commercial cinema, those who make films and succeed early and then they move to their sophomore or junior project, they're just overindulged and they have too much, and it turns into stuff that, what happened to the cool?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Giving up the cool, and that's what you're after.
Yeah, speaking of the budget, the Linda Hamilton, she talked about how there was a scene or something in the script where it said the corn was going to turn black at one point or something. And then she said, but New World was, kept lowering the budget and you didn't have the money. So everyone was like, oh, there's no, we can't have that happen. So it made me think, like, was there ever a plan to reveal, like, he who walks behind the rose? Was there ever, was that at
No.
all in the script, or was it never, ever going to be
Never. This was,
revealed?
back to my conversation with Roger and maybe even one of the lawyers who bought the company from Roger Corman, Roger Burbidge, and the lawyer, I think Larry Kuppen, or no, I
Okay.
think Harry Sloan.
Harry
But
Sloan, okay.
they specifically asked me, what do you think the monster is? Now, the script originally, before we attacked it and chopped it down to make it fit for the overall financial, I don't know, bucket of money. I just said, what's always scared me is the unknown, the
Yep.
making something familiar strange, to use that famous phrase. And it is the unknown as a child. It's the wind, it's the dark road, it's the leaves, it's the things we don't have an explanation for because we're new to them. And that's what we do. We don't want to see the monster. What we want to do is imagine and make the audience participate and use reception theory to get them to dig what's going on. So that's what it is. But at some point, we did have to have a visual, and that became some borrowed Kawasaki motorcycle commercial footage turned upside down and run backwards and processed, and that's the thing that grows over the corn. It's some cloud tank work I borrowed from a
Yeah, I mean, isn't
cinematographer
it
friend.
like he put injected, he was filming and injecting how like liquid would move and sort of created this cloud by injecting different liquid into, I mean, you
Yeah.
explained it on the Blu-ray, but it was fascinating to look at and as you're explaining to be like, that's what this is? That's
That's what it
incredible.
is. I mean, it's one of those science film kind of things. when I made TV commercials, I first worked for a company, and that's where I met a lot of different people. And those are the guys that you kind of grow up with. But one of them was a guy that pushed the broom with me when we were like 20 years old, and he became a cinematographer. And one of his challenges for Kawasaki through the production company was to create plates so that the motorcycle would be in a cloud and they could control the cloud. So he started shooting oil into a very thin layer of water in a tank, like a big square pan, but close, and using colored waters and lights. And then this became a slow motion effect. And it gives you that growing amoeba-like cauliflower brain-like thing. And it's very cool. It's been done over the years for a lot of things. It was just to be a background atmosphere plate for the motorcycle, but they didn't like it. So he said, "I got this. What do you think?" "Oh, fuck. Yeah, I want that. That's it. We'll turn that upside down." Yeah.
And I
Yeah.
love that. I love that you said that, and that was kind of the genesis or the birth of it, because I grew up in the Midwest surrounded by cornfields. And it was like the most boring, it's cornfield boring. And so to watch Children of the Corn and be like, "Oh my goodness, corn can be scary and cornfields can be scary." I love that you said that, because it's so true. Something so mundane that I drove past miles and miles of growing up. It wasn't until I saw that movie that I was like, "Oh, like I don't want to go through here at night anymore."
We succeeded. Yeah,
That's
that's
right.
it. I mean, it's the familiar turning it to be strange. That's it was a Russian social theorist in the 20s, I think, said that Victor Tsiolkovsky or Sikorsky or something. I used to teach that crap. I forget it now.
Yeah, and you do that a lot in the movie too, in terms of like the gore and everything. There's a lot of like cutting away before things happen. It's all sort of implied, and it makes the movie like I think you guys even talk about it during the commentary. It's a rated R movie, but really should be PG-13. It's not very bloody, but it feels way more intense because you're using your imagination.
Yeah, it's true Russian editing. That's all it is. If you really look at the theories of what visual perception is all about, when you connect two images, that join makes you feel like it is continuous, but yet you're really putting in, you're adding, I'll sound stupid again, but I don't know who said this, Arnott or someone. Art is knowing what to leave out. You make the audience participate. You make the audience put in what we leave out, primarily to suck them into it. And so that's what makes all that stuff so good. And then the audio track, we could have done better. If we made the film today, I can't imagine how cool it would be with the digital enhancements and all the good effects that are just dirt cheap and everything. It would be great. Volume screens so you don't have to go outside at night. Oh, man. Talk about getting fat. That would be the place to be.
Because you did have to shoot part of it back in LA, like in a studio, right? I mean, so you get to do like certain inserts and certain things with the like the corn moving out of the way and those kinds of things.
Yeah, not so much that. A lot of that stuff was done there, but there was a tremendous amount. We could go through the film and we could point them all out, which is surprising how many there are of cornfields, or the car going in certain directions, or the coffee shop murder. I think most of that, a lot of the inserts, cups and people choking and everything, those are all on a flat in the stage that we borrowed over a weekend. Again, keeping the resources down. So shoot the primary footage, the foundational imagery on location, and fill it in later when you can work with four people instead of five or 100 people. So cut labor by just, and I know how to shoot, so we don't need the cinematographer. I'll light it, I'll do it, and I got exploited again. But it was fun. Yeah.
Yeah,
I enjoyed
we talked to
it.
David Simpkins, who was a New
Oh.
World executive at the time, and he talked to us a little bit about those reshoots because I think he's
Yeah.
Peter Horton's leg that gets wrapped up in the corn and it's then shot and then rolled in reverse so that it looks like it's wrapping around his leg when really it's being pulled off. And he was like, "Yeah, that was my leg," and that was his then opportunity to meet Linda Hamilton.
Well, he's also in the end, where the monster is attacking everyone, hiding and shielding in the barn. He's one of the kids in there too. He pops up and down. Look for him. He has glasses. He's about
Wow.
22 years old, and he's got glasses on. He's
Yeah.
great. He became a very good, popular screenwriter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We did a commentary for Adventures in Babysitting with him,
Yeah,
which
that's
he
right.
wrote at New
Yeah.
World.
And that's Mark and I's secret too. We just wear glasses to look younger.
Yes,
So,
exactly.
because we're like,
I'm
nobody will
actually
know.
I'm 26, so
I
Speaking of the budget again, not to keep bringing that up, but there's cut certain cuts you had to make. You couldn't shoot everything. In fact, there's Malachi's death originally was supposed to be Isaac lifting him and dragging him through the corn. Wasn't that originally how
That's
that was supposed to
probably
go?
true. I can't recall exactly what the narrative was on all of it. I don't even think it's in the script that I still have, which is a collection of colored pages because there were so many changes. Location, realities changed a lot of the ability of what we could do and could not do. But there was staged, I think, I mean, there was written a much stronger, more climatic battle between the two evil forces. It wasn't just that, including the shooting of the cross into the air and all that. That was after the fact. Again,
And
yeah.
did you shoot the entire Blue Man scene?
The entire which scene,
Blue
Mark?
Man scene, the cop scene that there is a still from it, of course, that was infamous and got passed around and got a lot of people excited about this extra scene of because you only see the Blue Man up on the corn cross.
Yeah. I don't
I
know.
think that's the best answer.
I'll be honest. I've been
Remember, less is
asking.
more. Less is more. Eat
Less
some
is more.
podcast. Less
That's
is
right.
more.
That's right.
Actually, we ran out of Blue Man uniforms, and so we couldn't. The deal was, I've been asked a number of times, and I recall still photographs in a train station lobby. I remember being there because we used it for part of Peter Horton's stalk around town, his little Siddhartha to find things. And Bruce Barber, the stuntman, I believe, was the Blue Man, but I don't remember seeing footage with the editor of that. We may have put it together, and Harry said, time-wise, this drops the momentum. Let's put it aside for a while. And then over the course of the next 10 weeks of really fine-tuning the edit, the assembly, you just forget things. And people have asked, I imagine it's in the I don't know, the lockers someplace where all the negative is kept. It's
Right,
got to be
sure.
there because
Whatever that mysterious locker, wherever that
if
is,
it
where
still
that's being
exists, maybe
stored.
they threw it all away. I don't know.
Yeah,
Digital, I don't know.
I don't know. Hey, you were talking about all the different pages. Did you work with George Goldsmith on different rewrites? Was he available to you to work with? Because I know he was the one who wrote that draft.
Yeah, George is a good guy. We got along really well. We worked on a couple of other projects afterward that we didn't get made, but we became good friends. He's a went to university upstate New York where I grew up and stuff. So we had a lot of camaraderie, a New York kid from Long Island. And he and I, Don Borchers and Terry Kirby, all got together on a Saturday and took the script that was sold to be made, knowing that it needed to be trimmed, knowing that that particular version didn't really have strong act breaks and didn't have the movement of the structure that you would expect for this type of genre product. And I remember Borchers had a pair of scissors that you use to cut fabric that are like this long, you know? And he would pick up a page and go, we all agree. And he'd make one, whoosh, that's gone. And it would fall aside. And he would tape that to another piece of paper. And then we get something else. Whoosh, and then he'd tape that up. And that became the joint. And that's what shortened it down. That was the rewrite. And
Wow.
George also, I remember, was challenged with the responsibility to make what we called the Captain Kirk speech because there was no. Let's call it the transformation, what the hero does to the kids. He doesn't bring them around in the original script. And George was made to write this. Look, you're following, the theme, dogma. You're following the wrong thing. You can't do this. You can't let people tell you what. That was, I think, one of the strongest changes he contributed. A lot of he and I on the phone, like you would normally do, or I got something, you got something.
Yeah, was he
Yeah.
wasn't there on set then, you're saying?
No, 900K. That's a hotel room. That's extra food. That's a
Sure.
toilet. That's lunches. Then he's going to want to bring his dog. And oh no, this is going to be a mess.
Yeah.
That
Yeah.
was a
Even in
stretch.
Iowa.
Yeah. Come on.
That's pricey.
Yeah, no,
Yeah.
I get it. I get it. You had spoken to Roger Berlich. Had you spoken to anyone else at New World, or were you during the production, or was that one of your few interactions with New World Pictures at that point, shooting the movie?
When Terry and I took on the film, we were in kind of a wonderful position. Now, there's goods and bads to this. In other words, being our first film, we were paid almost nothing for our contribution and creative input. But that's all right. I mean, everybody kind of does that to get their hand in the door. Because in commercials, you can make a boatload of money, and we were fine. We could go back to, that's good tasting tuna, and we could pay 2 months' rent on that at the time. So they gave us almost creative freedom. Deliver on this day a film, and we have to have it. And we will talk to you during the process, and we'll help you, and we'll provide whatever we can. But we're not going to lean over your shoulder and tell you what to have to do constantly and so forth. We did have the completion bond people there because schedule had to be maintained, and they were very nervous about how I was going about doing things. But we would catch up, we'd slow down, we'd catch up, so forth. But they were not a heavy-handed group, and I felt very comfortable with them, and it made for a great relationship to, after the film, after it opened and did some money, to go into the studio and be in the Monday morning pitch meetings with everybody and talk new stories and, okay, go make this. Okay, you do that. And it was really cool. I felt very good with them. I got a great shake out of them in the end. I mean,
Good.
they were fine.
That's great. That's great to hear.
We all knew what we were making, genre
Right.
product. We were not making Gone with the Wind. Our quality, our integrity to make Gone with the Wind was all there.
Sure,
But
sure.
we had a small fan. We didn't have the wind.
Gone with the breeze.
Do you know what happened with the cornmobile? You held on to it for a little bit, right?
Oh yeah, I got to take one of them home. I was, at the end of a film, as you all know, there's a lot of assets and you have to divest. You cannot carry on the assets because there's costs in maintaining all these things. So companies spread it all out. And in this case, there were two cornmobiles, one for shooting interior car and one for the exterior car run-bys and pass-bys and so forth. And no one wanted it. And they said, "You need a car. Why don't you take this?" So, okay, fine. So I had the cornmobile for about, oh, maybe 2 years. I drove it around Los Angeles. And then my housekeeper at the time, she had no way to move around. So I gave it to her. And she
Oh.
got married, and her husband was a shade tree mechanic. And I think they sold it for a lot of money
Wow.
in downtown LA.
I hope there's still not that kid in the trunk. That would really
No, well,
be
yeah,
awkward.
it did have some accessories, but I think the kit had been cleaned out by then.
So when the Children of the Corn comes out, it was a big success. I mean, it was a huge success.
Very
And
well, yeah.
were New World like immediately like, hey, let's make another movie.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I'll say that proudly and also with boasting at the same time. I mean, literally, it opened to like the fourth spot in the box office. Knowing this kind of film, a genre product has about a 2 week window, and you're going to drop 50% the second week in ticket sales. They're very happy with that because then it went global. And that's when the accounting kind of no one saw it anymore, and it made a lot of money, and no one knows how much. But the domestic work was very good. So we talked quickly about another product, and that became the Romeo and Juliet Tough Turf. And so that got together, I guess, within about 6 months.
And it was the script pretty much finished for that as well?
It was in shape, but they brought in another writer. I believe the original idea was written by a man, and then New World wanted an edgier, tougher thing, as I did. I kind of wanted to do something a little bit more along the lines of the growing MTV, which was just starting at that time, or the power of the music. And I had my faves in music, and I wanted to also explore what I'd been learning with Harry Karamidas, the editor, about editorial styles and the impact of the collision of imagery and so forth, and all that kind of stupid film study shit you read in books that, one day you get to do. And so they brought in this woman who took a pen name, which is embarrassing Jet Rink, how can you be rebel without a cause? You just don't touch certain royalties in Hollywood history. But she took that name, and she had some really good, strong ideas. She was a very strong woman who had very strong ideas about social interaction and what certain demographics are all about. She lived it. So she added a lot of grit. And then we went out to do it and tried to make it real gritty, but we're kind of pulled back because it wasn't bright enough for the drive-ins. It wasn't bright enough for the movie. So it got printed a little bit differently.
And that writer you're talking about, that was Ida Mae Peterson?
Yes, that was her name. That's right. And she went by Jet Rink for the
Yeah, on the for the script,
credit.
yeah.
And I think that's her only credit. I don't know if she did any more. I don't know.
Did you consider doing any other project, or was this the one where you presented like a few different projects, much like Children of the Corn, or was this sort of the one that you gravitated to?
This one, it came quickly, and Don Borchers came with it again, saying, "Hey, this is cool. I've dreamed up this idea. I love it. Wait, I want to spell it like this. Here's what it's about." And I said, "Oh, it's like Romeo and Juliet, like West Side Story, like modern. Okay, what do we do? Well, let's talk." And so we started fiddling a little bit with what it could be in and around Los Angeles with a little larger budget, a little longer schedule. Little bit more upscale actor hires and stuff like that. Although they were all brand new, really. And the studio went for it just based on you guys do it. Terry stayed making television commercials. And at that point, I said, I think I'm going to go in the feature world. So you go, and if you're going to stay making commercials, then that's it. And we knew a British director that we had worked with who came in and took over that side of it for the commercial company. And
And so in
there
terms of
was only
cat,
one.
oh,
To answer
you,
your question, I'm sorry, Ryan, I didn't really answer.
no, you, no, okay.
That was just the first one that came to me. The agents had sent me lots of scripts. I was getting some really cool scripts from lots of people, like RoboCop and all kinds of cool things. I loved it. And met with lots of people who, well, we're going to do this later and all this. And I said, okay, I'll do that. This is cool. I didn't understand Hollywood cinema studio work at all. I was still like a TV commercial guy. Oh, you have a job, I'll take it. And this one seemed to rotate to the front the quickest. So let's go do it.
And so when you came into casting, again, you work with Linda Francis.
Yeah.
So what made you decide on James Spader or Robert Downey Jr.? What was the thought process?
Well, to be honest, Linda had she had the pick. Not she had the choice and it was her choice. She had the skill to pick out of a room. That person is a star. This person is a lummox. This one shouldn't be here. She wouldn't use that language, but she had just this unique ability to identify good talent, particularly talent that was coming up or was the right for certain roles. She had worked with Don Borchers on products. They were pretty good friends. And when we started talking about it, she was very strong on Jimmy Spader. His background was, again, just as a second banana, third banana in a film. He wasn't really well known. This was his leap to being a lead. The others, we cast auditioned people in New York and Los Angeles, went through lots of different people. I'll tell you a story and you're going to cringe and call me stupid. My wife does all the time now. About this film. But at that time, there were a lot of actors who today are very big. And we saw everybody, male and female. And Bob Downey was in New York and he was just a goofus on his audition tape. I mean, he was funny and he was reading for the Spader role. And I just said, no, he's the guy that should be the sidekick. This is, the Gene Autry thing. This is the guy. This is going to be great. He's cool. And I had no idea who his father was or what his background was whatsoever. He was new to film pretty much outside of working with his dad
His
on a
dad, yeah.
couple films. Yeah. And so she wanted Spader. I was real strong on Downey. And then the others just kind of fell in. They were good, strong actors. They were cool. We did a little stunt casting with Katia Sassoon, Vidal Sassoon's daughter, thinking that might bring some name of value to it. But she was also very good, and she was only 15 at the time, I think.
She lied about her age, did she not?
Well, yeah, but she also, as far as child labor laws, she became emancipated. through the state system. Therefore, she could act as an adult under the adult rules, but still with some kind of limits on what she could do. But she was very good about it, and the kids just got along really well. I mean, I shouldn't call them kids, but everybody did really well.
Maybe if they were kids at the
They were, and
time,
we had a lot of fun and goofed off, and still it was hard, but it was fun, you know.
sure. Was it Linda's idea to cast Kim Richards, or did?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we saw a lot of women, a lot of very capable women, but Kim Richards was of the cast members. She had the most visibility and identity with the Disney shows, with the Disney,
Right.
what we call Witch Mountain.
Escape from Witch Mountain.
Escape from Witch
Yeah.
Mountain.
And that really was the hinge for the studio to say, okay, there is a bankable, recognizable name internationally. She will be recognized, and that'll bring in tickets. Unfortunately, the tradition or the conventions are that the women don't bring in the tickets as much as the male name does, but she added some enough value and was good, and she was strong, so it was cool. And she had a great look, and she was quite there all the time.
I know you mentioned that she had sort of a difficult relationship at the time, but how was she to work with?
She was lovely. I shouldn't laugh. She was great to work with. And she was in a relationship with a man that she eventually married. So
Okay.
Friday, she would be full of energy and great. And then Monday, over the weekend, they'd be in a fight. And then Monday, she was, difficult, and, she was challenged emotionally. And then Tuesday, her dressing room would be filled with roses. I mean, filled with roses, no room to walk. So Tuesday, Wednesday, great. And then Friday, there would be some disruption and whatnot. So it would go up and down. But it didn't make a difference. When it was time to do the work, she was together and she was on top of it, and she was great. But
You
yeah,
mentioned
eventually married. It's
Brian
sort
and
of,
I have a very similar relationship.
yes.
We get
You
along
noticed
great, and then we fight, and then I fill his side of the bed with Blu-rays, and then it's all good again. I just,
that.
bouquets
That's
of
where all this, that's what all this has come from.
Blu-rays
He's
and
so
DVDs
cheap,
and the occasional
Blu-ray.
VHS, and then we're good.
Can't believe he, this guy, he works for Blu-rays. This is good.
It's easy and
Yeah.
also a nightmare.
I'm a real dinosaur.
We all have them. We all have them. I have them in the other room.
I've got tons of records in the other room, all the Blu-rays in this room. I'm just, I like all that sort of stuff. And our kids think I'm an idiot. But
No, not at
anyway,
all. What my daughter, who's now 39, just got a phonograph, and she keeps talking about all the records she's now collected. And I said, look, and wait till you're back here and you look at the, from college, we all have these long bins, those milk cartons, two, three, four of them filled up. Look, I've got original Zeppelin. Oh, Dad.
That's so funny. Our daughter just asked me, do you have any Led Zeppelin t-shirts? And then she goes, have you heard of them? I was like, I can't breathe.
I've
Yeah,
heard
I
of
think I've
them.
heard of them.
Yeah, I'm aware of who Led Zeppelin is. You haven't just discovered some gem that no one else has heard of.
No, I know
One thing you mentioned in your commentary is that that scene where Nick steals Morgan's bike in front of the school,
that.
you were going to shoot that in a way that really highlighted Morgan's disorientation, but New World did not, I guess, did not approve or didn't like it. Can you explain what you were how exactly you were going to shoot that, what exactly you were going to do?
This is where I learned a lot, and I learned it from the camera operator, Elliot Davis, who is now a major cinematographer. His work is terrific. Catherine Bigelow, kind of, he did Dogtown, and he's done Michelle Pfeiffer films. Anything she's done, he's done. He's great. And we still stay in touch. In fact, I was hoping he was going to do this new film with me. And he would always talk about the composition of the frame and the traditions of how things work in cinema, where it's close up against close up and people look at each other. But as long as they look in the proper screen direction, then the continuity and the comfort of the audience is that, oh, that person is talking to this person, and we see this, even though there is a join between them and they are not in the same physical space. You understand this, right? So if you The audience is comfortable with that. If you'd like to make the audience uncomfortable, then move them to the opposite sides of the frame, they'll still look in the proper direction, but the audience will have to turn their head and now they'll interact and they'll become more kinetic. There'll be more of a kinetic feel. And I thought, oh, that's cool. What if we change completely the screen direction when someone's completely disoriented so we don't know where they're looking and now the audience will feel the spin and they'll do all this? So that's what I shot. And they kept saying, this guy knows nothing about screen direction and whatnot. This is the worst shit I've seen. Put it back the way it's supposed to. So poor Mark Grossman, who I made commercials with, who's a great friend, said, we could steal this shot from this and this and from this take and this, and we'll put it back together. So it's not going to be exactly as powerful as it was, but it will satisfy this continuity issue. That was some of the stuff I played with, like the jump cutting and the color frames and a bunch of other things that I was experimenting with, thinking, why does it always have to be the same? Here's a standard, conventional Shakespearean story. Everyone knows it. Let's make it different. Let's do as much as we can. I tried even, we used, at the time, there was a camera that was called an Aeroflex 2C. It was a non-sound recording camera. It was very noisy, like a coffee grinder. And when you turned it off, it would slow down. And a lot of times it would slow down and the shutter would be open, so the frame would flash pure white. And then eventually transparent. So you'd see the exposure go from normal to just blossom out. So I thought, how cool would it be if we include those kind of things in the scene? We would flare out in these, everybody that were making a film, be reflexive. Don't just be, oh, this is reality, that kind of stuff. Well, that didn't work either. But someday it'll work because we're cutting a lot of those kind of things. And Mark was willing to do it and try it, but it became too radical. Again, your audience has to accept it. And if they're put off by it being too different, then we'll lose ticket sales. And I get it. So, okay, we'll do what you want to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bummer to not be able to at least try some of these experiments. I mean, you talked about it being sort of you were influenced by a French New Wave, which with this kind of story, you could totally see this having that kind of influence. And this is completely a story that the French New Wave would have made,
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I still dig that stuff. I think that's the cool stuff, just almost the verite. Just go and let's see what happens. Don't worry. I mean, they're beauty marks. They're not mistakes. They're beauty marks. And you just let them happen. And it's very cool when those kind of things. I don't know if you know the film by Charles von, no, Dogma, Danish.
Yeah, the Lars von Trier.
Lars von Trier. He made a film which was recorded on a computerized camera that would choose the compositions randomly. And it's a fantastic film. And I think it's called The Boss of Bosses. And it's about a Danish man who's an actor who is hired by a company owner to portray him as the company owner because the people who want to buy the company don't like the company owner. So he's got to have a shill come in and be this. So this actor comes in to be the company and he presents all kinds of problems. But sometimes the heads are over here, sometimes they're half in the frame, sometimes they're up here. The camera just, they push the buttons and the camera go, we'll be here. And when assembled, it's beautifully smooth. It makes no difference. We're watching the content. We're not watching necessarily the continuity of everything. We give into it. So, the French New Wave and others, you dig that stuff. Let's just watch, the reality of what's going on, not the, who cares about the technology sometimes?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or the convention of the technology.
You mentioned that you have we were talking about records. This movie obviously has a lot of soundtrack. Soundtrack plays a big role. Were
Yeah.
you involved in the selections for the soundtrack or the music track for it?
Yeah. I mean, Jim Carroll was, I demanded, we got to have Jimmy Carroll. He's great. And Don, again, the producer, had an affection for, oh, shoot, what was the guy's name? The Destroyers. Somebody in the Destroyers. Guitar player.
Southside Johnny
No, he was in the film.
or
This was.
Jack Mack and the Heart Attack?
Now, again, that's another one of my faves from LA club scene. This was a guy who had a lot of records at the time. A beer, a shot, I can't pay my rent. I can't think of his name. I'm fading here.
Dale
Something from the
Gagnea?
Destroyers. He played
Oh,
guitar.
okay.
He's a boogie-woogie guy. He's still
Oh, I
around.
see.
He's really good. And I kept saying, no, this is cool. Catholic Boys. This guy is hip. He's underground. He's the cool stuff. He'll be, let's go. And, it worked out. All that was required was Jim wanted to be in the movie. He wanted a line or so. Fantastic. We can do that. And then we became friends. I saw his show a couple of times. His wife was wonderful. And I was very saddened when he passed away. He was a good kid. And he had great stories of Lou Reed and Andy Warhol and the factory in downtown when he used to hang out there. He was great. He's a very
Yeah.
interesting guy.
I love his record that came out at the time. I think it's Catholic Boy, I think it's called. Great
Catholic Boys,
record.
yeah. That was
Great
the first
record.
one. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good. And I love having him in the movie. A friend of my college roommate, in fact, that I moved when I moved in with him, he had a Tough Turf poster in the room. So he was my entree to Tough Turf because he was such an enormous fan. He said he talked to Jim Carroll at a signing just after you guys had shot. And he said that he had one thing that he had to do is he had to pretend to play guitar. So it was just important that he play guitar, but he did not know how to play whatsoever.
No, nobody in that band knew how to play guitar. If you look closely, I think one of the guitars only has three strings on it. When I asked the kid, I said, "What are you doing with three strings?" He goes, "Hey, it's a punk. It's all right. Rock and roll." I said, "Okay, you're really into it." But Jack Mack was a band that I had followed all over LA when they would play because at the time, the new wave was coming in and it was cool. And Henry Rollins and the punks were pounding each other's heads on the street. And I'd go see them a lot in different clubs around the city. X, just Agent Orange. And it was a cool time. So they were there. And I love the soul band, the James Brown kind of stuff. And that's what we got him into. And Lena Lovitch was somebody else that I really enjoyed, and they pulled her out. Marianne Faithfull, oh, she did an album at that time, and her voice just knocked me out. So we enjoined her. She joined, and she and the composer, who was also the same composer for Children of the Corn,
Jonathan
spent like a
Elias.
Yeah, John spent like an hour just riffing him on the piano at his house, and she just sang and drank beer, whatever she did. And I have that cassette someplace, and it's just the coolest. She was great. I just,
Wow.
man, to have her be around it was a lot of fun. And Southside Johnny also is
He
somebody else.
does the theme song.
Yeah, I think John knew him. And because it was that kind of sound, that kind of Jersey stuff, I thought, oh, this is cool. Working man's. Yeah, that'll be great.
That same roommate I was telling you about, he wanted me to ask because he said in the on the VHS that Marianne Faithfull song is used, but it's actually Jonathan Elias singing it just in the VHS for some
Really?
reason. It's just that he was like he had no idea why that was the case.
I don't know anything about that. I know that John didn't have a singing voice and was, I thought Marianne Faithfull, as far as I know, on
Okay.
anything he's did.
I had to ask. He said it's been something that's been bugging him. So I don't know. I had to ask
Tell
because
him it's all true. Tell him it's not really him. Tell him it's, oh, I was going to tell you about this. Tell him it's this actor. So Bob Downey Jr. This character has a brother who owns the dogs. And when the original script, he was in it a little bit more.
Yeah, there's a scene where they have the
Understood.
dogs, right?
Yeah.
Where James, did you shoot that scene, Jim, when James Spader comes over and sees the dogs and
No, that got cut out
okay, before you shot it.
before. And now, oh, wait, where Spader runs in and says, "Have you seen?"
I think he says something like that, and then the dogs are barking, and he
Yeah,
asks about the
we
dog.
shot that. Yeah.
Okay.
The guy who played that role was a great looking guy and a very nice man. But when you see at that time all the actors in Hollywood of that age, you see a lot of different people. And I was digging through stuff for one of my classes and I found my books with all the notes and there were casting notes. And I went down and I saw the people that came in and there was George Clooney. And I saw my notes next to it and I said, he doesn't look like Bob Downey Jr. No good. So I told my wife, like, you dumb shit. Look at that Clooney in your movie. Yeah,
Well, to be fair, Clooney's aged very well.
he's
Like
done.
when you see him in his early stuff, he does look like the Clooney of today.
Yeah, no, he's truly the Clark Gable of fiction in the world.
Some might say he's aged too well. It's frustrating for the rest of
Yeah, that
us.
we always
Some
thought.
are saying that, just to let you in on a little best kept secret. Some are saying it. Some are saying it.
But he does make Clooney does make it into a New World Pictures movie because he's in Return of the Killer Tomatoes,
Yeah. Oh yeah.
and
No, he
Return
was
to
on
Horror
that.
High.
Linda
So,
Francis again brought him in. And we went through all that stuff. And so once somebody starts coming in by way of a casting agent, that casting agent will bring them in on other films. And Linda did quite a few films, I think, for New World. So she brought a lot of talent to New World, which was really cool, men and women. So it was really fun. And Jeff Greenberg, who worked with her, also brought talent, who became a major television casting guy.
Right, that's right. We were talking about that sequence that you had to recut with the bike, but were
Yes.
there other sequences that you tried to shoot that the studio said, we're not sure about this, or was that really the only big sequence you could
That
think of?
was one of the more complicated ones, in terms of discussion. I'll say it that way. And more of this or that. And I know on the day when we were shooting it, the assistant director, who was a senior guy, a Spielberg assistant director, kept shaking his head every time I'd want to put the cameras. No, it doesn't go over there. It goes over here. You're just wasting our time with that stuff. And we kind of got into disagreements, and I really didn't want him around because he was following a TV mode of making things. This is how you do it. It goes A to B to C. Don't try anything different. There was the ending was another time where the money was gone. We had gone too long in our schedule. The crew wanted to have their wrap party. Don just said, "That's it. We're not doing it anymore." And the wait, we don't have an ending for the story. We have no resolution. The hero does not transform. We don't have the moment where the hero actually says or shows that he's taught the woman something, and she now goes to college, or she finishes in a different direction than she finished. He doesn't show that he's made his destiny, not just change fate, that kind of crap. So that was the frustrating part. That was another big one. How do we make an ending? Because we didn't have it. We were short a day, literally.
Did you, was that th then the fight sequence? Did you do it by sort of extending that fight sequence?
Editorially, the fight sequence went on and we shot it, but we wanted to shoot another day to get more the end of the story,
Right. Yeah.
and
Because there's a
again.
scene in the hospital, right? There's a scene in the hospital at the very end that's in the shooting script, but doesn't get shot or
There
doesn't
is
make it in
one,
at very least.
there's one scene with Jimmy Spader and his father with Matt Clark in the hospital. I don't know about another one. I can't remember exactly what we had to take out, because once it's out, you just work with what you have. I mean, that's
Sure.
Herschel film.
Yeah.
You do what you have. And so kind of dreamed up that everybody comes together back at that nightclub and plays, and we did that in an hour or something. That's
Yeah.
all I'm
Yeah.
looking
I don't know.
for.
I thought that worked.
Yeah.
So, did you at all talk to the studio about maybe getting a little bit more money to try to finish the movie?
Well, at that time, Terry was not with me. So my partnership as a producer was I worked with Don, and Don was more studio guy than he was producer. So he was very heavy-handed on, we've been allocated this much money and we can't do that. He did not want to spend more than was in each category. He was rigid on spending, I'll put it that way. Even when creatively, Don, we could do this and do that. We could forget that. We'll do it over here. No, you got to do this, do that. I mean, I'll give you an example. When it came to second unit, simultaneous concurrent second unit, there were a couple of things with cars driving by or whatnot to splinter off a camera assistant and a camera operator to go shoot that. Elliot, go shoot the camera thing while we're shooting something else. Don, you go do this. Here's the storyboard. I draw it out for you quickly. The guys came back later and said, "The guy's he's really difficult. He looked at the storyboard and he said, Fritz wants the car to be right here, right here. It can't be right there. The tree has to be right here. The guy has to stand right there." And like, oh, I see. He was very specific about taking instruction and following through. It's his nature.
Very literal.
Yeah, so that became kind of how the budget was managed. And it became difficult, but
How long did it take to shoot that dance sequence?
I think we're that was one day, I believe.
Oh, wow.
Inside and outside. Then we went outside the building. No, we didn't. The building outside the building was in Hollywood, and the dance scene was in the warehouse downtown LA. So we did all the dance stuff inside in one day, I believe. That was it, probably a long day. But the man who choreographed all that, Bobby Bannis, was in West Side Story. And I just, man, as soon as I heard that, when I met him, it's like, you got to do this. I bow to you. He was one of the Jets
Oh,
dancers.
wow.
And
Wow.
so we became friends. And then he did choreograph Under the Boardwalk when we had to do some dancing in there. And I talked to him a couple of times before he died. He was a great guy, a friend of everybody in Hollywood who was a dancer because he was so important. He was great.
How long was did it take to rehearse that dance and to get it down?
Well, Bob had organized and rehearsed all the people beforehand, basically the principal dancers, and then we filled in the extras and ran through it a few times, two or three. And then, if I remember correctly, it was just a matter of getting on the crane and shooting and going to work and chopping it up different areas. The time-consuming problem with that is really the management of people, too many people together in an area, and how long does it take them to get out of there so we can shoot here? And then they all have to eat now, and that takes a half an hour. The actual blocking and shooting wasn't that bad. It was really the management of the crowd, because it's not digital. Those are real people,
Yeah,
100
right.
or whatever it was, 200 in the room.
I heard a couple of stories about Robert Downey Jr., or rather his character. Was Crispin Glover supposed to be in that at some point in time?
We met Crispin, yeah, and we talked with him, and he was a strong candidate. I think the two of them were probably the two strongest candidates. But Bob's affability and his fun and his just inventiveness was the reason I said, okay, this would be cool. We can just say, what do you think? Two different ways to do it, five different ways to do it. Come on, let's try something new. Crispin was a little bit more theatrical. And he wanted to be a little more internal, and I don't think that character needed that. I think the character needed to be external, a goof.
And you're saying nobody in the band knew how to play. Does that mean Robert Downey Jr. did not know how to play drums?
He learned a little bit. He was coordinated. He's an athlete. I'd played drums when I was in junior high and so forth. So I had a set of drums I dragged around with me because I always thought that would be cool. And so he took those and he rehearsed on those for about a week, 2 weeks. And we had a drum teacher teach him basic stuff, coordinate the beat and so forth. And then, just editing. You're on. And then it was a matter of syncing the beat to when he was doing what he was doing. But he actually did sit down and he played them. I won't say that I know that he played them like Gene Krupa could play them or Bonzo talking about Zeppelin. I didn't see any triple foot on him, but I did see him play it really well,
And so when you finished the movie, what was the studio's feeling? What did New World think about the movie?
Oh, they loved it. It made money right away.
Oh, that
That
okay, great.
I remember Harry Sloan saying, "Man, you made us a lot of money. We got to do another one, another one." And at the time, Don had arranged for a three-picture deal so I could make three films with New World.
So
Don
you basically.
Borchers, after Children of the Corn, so let's make a three-picture deal. Actually, it was part of Terry and I doing Children of the Corn, I think, that we didn't get any money, but if it was successful, we could have two other films with them. I think that's what happened. Or maybe it came in when I did the Tough Turf, I got a three-picture deal or whatever. But anyway,
Was this one of them? Was Tough Turf considered one of
yeah,
them and
Tough Turf
Children of
was
the
like the
Corn?
second. Yeah.
Okay.
second of the two. So they right away, this is cool. Let's go again. What do you want to do? That's cool. And back in those Monday morning pitch meetings with the studio chief, and he would say, "That sounds good. No, that's not." So we bounced around and didn't find anything for a while. And the New World made money and lost money and up and down.
Right. There's not many filmmakers that made three movies for New World, and you are one. I mean, I think there's only one other.
Joe Dante.
So
Didn't Joe Dante make
he
three?
made only he only made two, and one he co-directed. So he made Hollywood Boulevard, and then he did do Piranha, but then he moved
Commander
on.
Cody. Commander Cody and the Lost Airmen. Hollywood Boulevard. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah. No,
Fantastic
it's
film.
like you and Steve Miner.
Steve Miner, yeah. He did
Yeah.
quite a bit. He's had a great career.
And that's it. That is our talk with Fritz Kirsch. Hope you enjoyed this. Oh my gosh, Fritz, just an
I did.
absolute.
I know I did. So, I mean, am I are you talking to me?
Yeah,
'Cause I did.
I
I
think he was
you
talking
I
to me.
loved
I think he was
I
talking
loved
to me,
both
and
of
I
them.
did. I didn't
Oh, so.
really.
Oh,
I was talking to
okay.
you both. Yeah, I mean, I was hoping you guys enjoyed this. Did you
Oh,
guys enjoy
we
this?
did.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did.
Okay,
I
good. Yeah.
did.
How could
like
you
being a part
not?
of it, and I enjoyed listening to it again. So, I mean, it's a win-win on my part.
Damn it.
Thank you,
Damn it.
Fritz.
Thank you,
Loved it.
Fritz. So great to
Thank
talk to him.
you.
What a, again, as we talked to him about it, it's incredible that he got to do three movies for New World Pictures. There's not a lot of directors
Seriously,
got to do
I didn't
three
get to
whole
do
films.
one.
Yeah.
You never did. And you never did. And God, I know you
No.
were trying really hard.
I
You did you bring
was.
them Baghead? Did you let them? You
I
didn't submit
submitted the
it, did you?
script of Baghead to
Okay.
them. I didn't hear back, but I took that as they were thinking about it. So maybe they
There,
are
Mark,
still.
wherever you have that, there are people that release, shot on video films, and yours is less than an hour, I believe, but still, I think,
Some would call that a short. It's a short.
but pe there's a market
And
out there, is what I'm saying, Mark,
I think there is. So you can get a hold of me, Mark at New World Pictures Podcast, if you want a copy of Baghead. I think you'll be
I
worth your
would. I
time.
would. I haven't seen that
Yeah.
thing in
Well, then send the
decades.
email,
Quite
Ryan. You heard
frankly,
the instructions. You don't just get it. One doesn't just
I just have to
receive
send an email.
Baghead.
I
Follow
have
the
to send
steps.
the email. Yeah. Well, I don't know if Fritz is going to send you an email, but if he does, he's going to get a copy of Baghead, a movie you made back in your early 20s, and you'll see me in it in a wig. And we if you write Mark, we hope you get a copy. Hope you enjoy it. We hope you enjoy this interview. We hope you enjoy this episode. We hope you're enjoying June Gloom 2 Down to Frown.
I
If
am.
you want, we know you are, Mark. If you want to listen to all of our episodes and our interviews, you go to our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com. That's where you can find everything related to this podcast, including t-shirts. Buy a t-shirt. We will see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast, a part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening. To hear more shows from the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network, please select the link in the description.
Are you a film fan who loves the ultimate home video experience? Look no further than The Disconnected. Your host, Ryan Verrill, is your go-to source for the latest and most accurate information on home video releases, exclusive interviews with industry insiders and filmmakers, and has established a thriving community where every film and physical media enthusiast feels welcome. From hidden gems to blockbuster hits, The Disconnected brings you insider knowledge and a welcoming space to share your love of cinema. Watch every Thursday night at 9:30 Eastern, 6:30 Pacific for the live announcements show and follow The Disconnected on social media to stay updated. Subscribe to The Disconnected on YouTube or on the podcast provider of your choice and dive into a world where every movie night is an adventure.